Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Thursday, April 8th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Melody.
Well, it's great to be back, and it just needs to be refreshed and working very hard. And gold was working very hard today also. We have gold up 1840 today at 1757, kept most of its gains. The high was just $2 higher, so a nice day for gold. Silver was up 35 cents at $25.55. Platinum was up $5 at $1,236. Palladium was up three at $2,695. The USDX today was down 0.35 at 92.09. Crude oil's holding at 59.77. Paper markets today, you have, let's see, we're a little early, but we'll get, the S&P is notching another record high. That was up 17 points at 4,097. Dow Jones was up 55 at 33,501. The NASDAQ was up 140 at 13,829. Let's see. I was just reading a headline here, Dave, that these Florida is suing the CDC to allow cruises to resume U.S. sailings. So they want to be treated like airlines. I don't know if the cruise lines got any bailout money like the airlines did.
They got PPP money.
Did they? Everybody got PPP money, right?
Yep.
Except
they,
you and
they weren't so special.
Let's see. Let's go back and see what the 10-year yield did. 1.73. That hasn't changed. And that's about it. Bitcoin's up again today.
What are you talking about? The 10-year? 10-year is 1.62 today.
I wonder why. Yes, it is.
The fixed volatility index is at 17.
All right.
Maybe that's what you saw.
That's what I saw. All righty. It's great to be back. Let's see. What's interesting to talk about today? As usual, Thursdays is jobless claims. The unemployment insurance rose more than expected, despite some signs of that the job market is kind of in a healing mode. This was reported by the Labor Department today. The claims for the week ending April 3rd totaled 744,000. That's really pretty far above the expectation of 694,000. The total represents an increase of 16,000 from the previous week's upwardly revised 728,000. And, of course, this comes a week after a sign of more aggressive healing in the labor market. We saw the non-farm payrolls in March increase by 916,000, and U6 unemployment fell to just shy of 12%. Now, this was the biggest job gain since August, though unemployment remains well above its pre-pandemic U6 low that was around 7%. So, you know, continuing claims provide some good news, and on the labor front, with the total dropping 16 to 3.7 million. So, anything else in this report, Dave?
Economists said that filing backlogs could be one factor that's driving these high claims numbers, while spikes in COVID cases in some states could also be keeping numbers elevated. As we'll talk a little bit more about later in the program, despite recent progress in the jobs market, Fed officials say much more is needed on the jobs front before they think about changing interest rate policy. And it's from the most recent Federal Open Market Committee meeting, which came out yesterday, indicated a better outlook for the economy, though a continued need for easy policy. At the same time, Fed Governor Lyle Brainard said the economic outlook has, in her words, brightened considerably. There go those rosy lenses again, Melody. But she noted there are still about 9 million fewer workers than there were before the pandemic started. So I say still a lot more time needs to pass before we can see the forest through the trees here and really make out any trend.
Well, you know, it's, you know, we talk about an overheated stock market, and you've seen the number of signs that this is happening, with indicators of investor complacency and risk seeking is reaching the highest levels since 2007 and 1999. Both pre-crash years. And, you know, these are the periods of extreme euphoria that were followed by market crashes. As of late February, investors already had leveraged a record $814 billion borrowed against their portfolios. That's a 49% year-over-year increase. And this is the largest since 2007. The prior year, again, was the dot-com bubble in 1999. So you do have these professional money managers. They're selling. Data shows that large institutional investors were net sellers of equities for the fourth straight week last week, and hedge funds are beginning to join them. The too-big-to-fail Bank of America sell-side indicator rose for a third month in a row to a 10-year high. That's the closest to a contrarian sell signal since May of 2007. Bank of America points out that since March 2020, the average recommended allocation to stocks has risen by more than three times the typical rate following prior bear markets, Dave.
God bless her rational exuberance, Melody.
Yes.
The bank said increasingly euphoric sentiment is a key reason for our neutral outlook, as the cyclical rebound, vaccine, stimulus, et cetera, is largely priced into the market. Now, that could have been a Freudian slip, the use of euphoric, ladies and gentlemen, which, interestingly, at least as far as I can remember, has been tied normally to the use and influence of cannabis. So it could be that the bank is smoking that wacky weed, because some of these positions certainly are wacky. CBO VIX volatility index fell another 5+% yesterday to 17.16, although it was fairly flat today, but it's the lowest it's been since February 2020. Kenny Polcari at Case Capital Advisor says this low level continues to suggest complete complacency by investors, so worries over rising rates or rising inflation once again appear to be on the back burner. But oh, that too big to fail JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, he and some of his comrades are taking the other side of that bet. In his annual letter to shareholders, Dimon argued that strong consumer savings, vaccines, and the proposed infrastructure plan could lead to a Goldilocks moment for the market, brimming with sustained growth and slow inflation. And also, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, as we mentioned last week, the S&P 500 index is currently selling at over 35 times earnings. That's more than double its historical average. So once again, Melody, we shall see.
You know, and it is, I mean, if you just look at all these fundamentals and what's pumping it up, I mean, it is just amazing. And I guess you did have a lot of people off of work last year who didn't have anything to do but to trade stocks. So, but you know, it always happens, Dave. It's the same cycle. It's the same rhythm. It's the same you know, the big boys get out, you know, at these peaks and so forth. How long can it go? We don't know. Maybe it could go another year and a half. Who knows? But it's just amazing. Someone said to me today, you know, there. What about it? And again, the cryptos are keep popping up. Well, you know, Bitcoin's. I said, you know, I've heard it can go to 400,000. Well, now they're talking a trillion. And I reminded them, even if it did, I reminded them. I can remember when Zimbabwe had a $100 trillion note, and you couldn't buy a cup of coffee with it. I got one.
Man.
It's worthless.
I remember when inflation in Venezuela was just 7%.
Yeah. So, you know, it's all fine and dandy if you think those numbers are going to go that high, but it's not reality. And there's always that other side. That whatever propels that up there, there's other things that are happening. And again, it's all high inflation that's pushing these markets higher and higher. So, you know, it's just keep that in mind when you have people who are telling you, oh, gold's a bad deal. Gold is low. Gold is no good. Nobody's going to want your gold. Who are you going to sell it to? And it's like, who are these people? They always have another agenda, a different agenda that they want to sell you. They want you to sell your gold. Most of them can't buy it back. So, you know, they'll call me and say, I want to sell my gold and, you know, so forth. And, you know, it turns up that they, you know, go into some other paper investment because somebody's talked them into it saying that gold was a bad investment. Folks, gold is not a bad investment. People forget what the true fundamentals are for gold. And there will be so many buyers out there for your gold. We won't have enough product to sell. And prices will go higher. And so don't listen to these people. Stay the course. If you have additional funds, disposable income, that's fine, but don't ever sell your gold to trade for paper. That's just nuts. Anyway, you know, these poor folks are saving money. I guess that's a good thing. Consumers socked away 42 cents of every dollar received from the third round of money that they've gotten, $1,400. I didn't think all that money was sent out yet, though, Dave.
No, it's not. Like the first round, they're still missing addresses.
Oh, okay. I guess it's less than 25% of the funds. Is that it?
No. No, I mean, we've got, you know, the ones who haven't filed their taxes yet and who had issues with their 2019 or 2018 returns. They haven't gotten them. And also, Social Security Administration has not sent out all of the checks to retirees.
How come?
That's a good chunk. Well, I think the IRS had been sending all the other ones out, and I think the Social Security Administration had just computer programming issues that it had to complete before the checks could be sent to Social Security recipients. Hmm.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that changes this number. Will 42% still be saved? Will be saved?
Yeah, that's a good point. You would think that particularly people living on a fixed income might need that cash for whatever reason and would tend to spend more of it. Mm-hmm. So we'll follow that later on in the year as we get updated numbers.
Well, the households that were received $3,162 on average, the New York Fed said. Respondents reported 13% of the funds were expected to be spent on essential items on average and 8% on non-essential items, Dave.
Yeah, now in earlier rounds of stimulus, households spent a greater share of funds to meet daily living expenses. About 29% of funds dispersed via the initial round of checks last spring. were spent versus about 26% authorized by the pandemic relief package number two passed in December. Findings show that divergent needs facing households, with many continuing to face a high degree of uncertainty as evictions are largely on hold for a few more months and mortgage holders are receiving continuing loan forbearance. The household savings rate remains highly elevated instead of consumption, while households have been paying credit card debt in record fashion.
I think this is interesting. We've talked about this before. Mall vacancy rate hits a record high. And the vacancy rate for regional malls in the U.S. hit a record 11.4% in the first quarter this year, from 10.5% in the fourth quarter of 2020. Now, this is all according to Moody's analytics. The 90 basis point increase marks the highest the firm has ever seen, surpassing that record 80 basis point spike in the first quarter of 2009, and that was way back in the thick of the Great Recession. Victor Kalinog, malls said, malls are absolutely still on the ropes. They were on the ropes even before COVID. It's almost passe now to say that we have a record vacancy rate for malls because we've been breaking that record all year. The U.S. has about 1,000 malls. Shopper traffic to many enclosed malls, often situated in the suburbs, that has dropped steadily over the years. You have American spending reported $90 billion more online just last year.
I believe that might be $900 billion.
What did I say,
$90 billion.
$900 billion. Thank you. Many of the retailers within malls, including department stores, have increasingly struggled, of course, to stay relevant to the customers. And but we've seen so many that have been filing for bankruptcy protection, from JCPenney, we've seen Neiman Marcus, Brooke Brothers, and several more, many more. Industrial real estate has been the most resilient property type, with demand for warehouses that store goods and fulfill e-commerce orders that are surging, Dave.
Yeah, office space like retail continues to see heightened vacancy rates and declining rents. Many businesses are still grappling with what the future workspace will look like. Among the hardest hit areas suffering office rent declines are Charleston, South Carolina. It's down over 3.5%. New York, down 1.8%. And San Francisco, down what I think is a measly 1.6%.
Hey, that went by quick. We'll be returning here in just a few short minutes. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody the rest of the program as she attends to calls in the office. Call us at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Now, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. I guess you could say it was inevitable. On Etsy, eBay, Facebook, and Twitter, little rectangular slips of paper started showing up for sale in late January. Printed on cardstock, they measure 3 by 4 inches and feature crisp black lettering. Sellers listed them for $20 to $60 each with a discount on bundles of 3 or more. Laminated ones cost a little extra. All were forgeries or falsified copies of the CDC vaccination cards, which are given to people who have been inoculated against COVID in the U.S. Saud Khalifa, who founded the company FakeSpot, which offers tools to individuals and businesses to detect fake online listings, said, "We found hundreds of online stores selling the cards. Potentially thousands were sold." Now, the pandemic for sure has made opportunists out of many people, like those who hoarded bottles of hand sanitizer last March or those who cheated recipients out of their stimulus checks. Now, online scammers have latched on to the latest profit-making initiative, the little white cards that provide proof of shots. Those efforts are far from hidden, with Facebook pages named Vax Cards and eBay listings with blank vaccine cards openly hawking the items. It's unbelievable. Selling fake vaccination cards could break state and federal laws that forbid copying the CDC logo. And if the cards were stolen and filled out with false numbers and dates, they could also violate identity theft laws. But profiteers have pressed ahead as demand for these cards has grown from anti-vaccine activists and other groups. Airlines and other companies have recently said they may require proof of vaccination so people can safely travel or attend events. The cards may also become central to these so-called vaccine passports, which offer digital proof of vaccinations. Now, some tech companies developing vaccine passports ask people to upload copies of their CDC cards. Los Angeles, the city, for example, also began using the CDC cards for its own digital proof of immunization. And last week, 45 state attorneys general banded together to call on Twitter, Shopify, and eBay to stop the sale of false and stolen vaccine cards. The officials said they were monitoring the activity and were concerned that unvaccinated people would misuse the cards to attend large events, potentially spreading the virus and prolonging the pandemic. Josh Shapiro, who's Pennsylvania's attorney general, whose office has investigated fraud related to the virus, says we're seeing a huge market in this state for false cards online. He noted it as a dangerous practice that undermines public health. One Etsy seller who declined to be identified said she had stolen dozens of fake vaccine cards for $20 each recently. She justified her actions by saying she was helping people evade a, quote, tyrannical government, unquote. She added that she did not plan to get inoculated. Shapiro said that in addition to violating federal copyright laws, the sale of counterfeit and stolen cards most likely breaks civil and consumer protection laws that mandate that an item has to be used as advertised. He added that the cards could also violate state laws regarding impersonation. We live in interesting times, ladies and gentlemen. And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, let's talk some specifics about gold. It's a new week. It's a new day, for that matter. But this week, gold continues to hold its ground again around neutral territory, rising this week and again today, even as the Fed seemingly remains unconcerned about inflation or rising bond yields. As was mentioned on yesterday's program, the minutes from the Fed's March policy meeting showed that the FOMC discussed the sharp rise in bond yields, which were trading at a one-year high above 1.6% at the time of the meeting. Of course, it's since been higher than 1.75, although it's down around 1.7 today, as Melody mentioned. Now, the Fed minutes reported that officials commented on the notable rise in longer-term Treasury yields that occurred and generally viewed it as reflecting the improved economic outlook, some firming in inflation expectations and expectations in general for increased Treasury debt issuance. It continued, disorderly conditions in Treasury markets or a persistent rise in yields that could jeopardize progress toward the committee's goals, i.e., you know, full employment and 2% inflation, were seen as cause for concern. Now, when it comes to inflation, the Fed was also blasé on what some investors see as a growing threat in the financial markets. Again, quoting from the minutes, most participants noted that they viewed the risks to outlook for inflation as broadly balanced. Several remarked that supply disruptions and strong demand could push up price inflation more than anticipated. Others commented that the factors that had contributed to low inflation during the previous expansion could again exert more downward pressure on inflation than expected. Now, although bond yields have been rising steadily since the start of the year, the minutes show that the Fed's in no hurry to change its ultra-accommodative, easy monetary policy. While there was some optimism that the economy could see a stronger-than-expected recovery, the committee noted that the pandemic has created a lot of uncertainty, and I hope that's what listeners and investors in general will hone in on, and the uncertainty, because it tells you that gold is there for you as that insurance policy for you and your family. The economist Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics said that all things considered, there is little here to suggest that the Fed will wait. There's little here to change our view that the Fed will wait until late 2023 before beginning to raise interest rates again. Now, although gold prices have struggled to attract sustainable bullish momentum so far this year, numerous analysts, ourselves included, remain optimistic that gold will remain well supported by its fundamentals and as interest rates stay near their historic lows, especially as real interest rates are affected by inflation over the long run. Now, in a related story, rising bond yields and resilient strength in the U.S. dollar in general took their toll in the gold market last month as investors liquidated their gold-backed exchange traded funds at an unusual pace. That's according to the latest data from the World Gold Council. The WGC said that 107.5 tons of gold, worth about $5.9 billion U.S. dollars, flowed out of global ETFs last month. The report noted that the gold market had seen strong outflows in four of the last five months. This was also the second month in a row where net outflows ranked in the top 10 worst outflows historically. It should have been a big sign, ladies and gentlemen, that it was the right time to buy. And now we see another week and we're heading up again. Now, since the peak asset levels in November 2020, gold ETF holdings have fallen nearly 9% in tonnage terms on a par with the approximate loss in the price of gold over the same period. Now, obviously, we have a strong bias against gold ETFs. We believe the only real gold is physical gold, coins and bars. But we talk about this because I think it enhances the big picture. And unfortunately, the ETFs are driving, the ETF flows are helping to drive the price of gold a lot more than they had in the past. Now, Juan Carlos Artigas, who's director of investment research at the WGC, said that it's not surprising that the gold market saw strong outflows, as expectations have picked up that the U.S. will see a strong recovery from the pandemic. He added that tactical investors have been taking profits in the gold market as momentum has slowed compared to last year. However, and it's a big however, he added that strategist investors continue to see long-term value in gold and are providing critical support. He also noted that investors also need to view the outflows in a broader context, as last year saw historically high demand, especially in ETFs. He said, so it's natural for the gold market to see some outflows as investors continue to take profits from last year's record rally. He said, this is a natural rebalancing of the gold market. Now, after a pause in central bank gold buying last year, there are signs of new activity in the space as Hungary has tripled its gold reserve so far this year, sort of going against the trend of what we just talked about in the ETFs. Hungary's central bank raised its gold reserves to 94.5 metric tons from 31.5 tons. I believe that's this quarter, first quarter. This marked one of the most significant central bank gold purchases in decades. The decision to triple its gold reserves was also based on the need to manage new risks arising from the COVID pandemic, according to the central bank. It also referred to gold as one of the most crucial reserve assets worldwide, stating it carries no credit or counterparty risks. Are you listening, Citibank? Are you listening, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan Chase, Credit Suisse, Nomura? Robust central bank gold buying over the last decade, in fact, has helped to keep gold prices elevated in general. So we'll be following this story as the year goes on as well. Now, switching to manufacturing, in what certainly will be another hit to jobs in the economy, at least temporarily. General Motors is temporarily idling or extending shutdowns at several plants in North America. That's due to the ongoing semiconductor chip shortage impacting the global automotive industry. The temporary plant closures range from a week or two to several additional weeks or months for plants that have already been idled due to parts disruption. GM will restart production this Monday of mid-size pickups after a two-week shutdown due to the shortage at a plant in Missouri. Now, the cost of these closures have been factored into the company's earnings forecast for the year, according to GM. The automaker expects the problem will reduce its operating profit by between $1.5 million and $2 billion this year. That's no chump change, ladies and gentlemen. Now, we don't have comparable numbers for the other U.S. Automakers at this time, but we'll let you know as we learn of them. Semiconductors are key components used in the infotainment, power steering, and braking systems of vehicles, among other things. Well, we've been talking a lot about the Archegos hedge fund debacle last few weeks, and today Senator Sherrod Brown, who's the chair of the powerful Senate Banking Committee, is taking aim at three banking giants' ties to Archegos after the hedge fund's recent losses blitzed the market and provided examples of Wall Street banks' risky investments in derivatives. In letters to the leaders at Goldman Sachs, Nomura, and Credit Suisse, Brown indicates he's looking for details on their relationship to Archegos. A separate letter was reportedly sent to Too Big to Fail Morgan Stanley. Archegos, the family investment office run by Bill Wang, triggered a sell-off in stocks like Discovery and Viacom CBS last month when it was forced to liquidate its positions in those companies, many of them through derivatives known as credit swaps. Several banks were caught in the fallout. Credit Suisse and Nomura were two prime brokers that took significant losses. In fact, two executives at Credit Suisse announced they'd be stepping down because of it. Goldman and Morgan Stanley, on the other hand, managed to sell most of their stock related to its Archegos margin calls and apparently avoided any major losses. But as we've been reporting, their Archegos investments revealed an ongoing practice in investing in risky derivative products in the trillions of dollars. Now, Brown's letters are the first response from Congress that hint at a possible investigation and go beyond initial statements that merely condemn the market chaos. The Banking Committee in the Senate has jurisdiction over the world's largest banks, oversight jurisdiction, and regularly engages with the SEC, which has reportedly opened its own preliminary investigation into Wang and his recent trades. Brown's letters to the three banking officials try to delve into the links between the financial institutions and Archegos. It says the massive transactions and losses raise several questions regarding banks' relationship with Archegos and the treatment of so-called family offices. Well, we'll stop there. Ask you to hang in for another short break. We'll be back after these important messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back one more time to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Boy, you got to love that enthusiasm of Beth Ann. Melody will be back tomorrow, by the way, with the Rev, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern time. The median household net worth in the U.S. is $121,700. But it's almost double that for those in their late 50s and early 60s. According to the Fed's latest survey of consumer finances, the median net worth of Americans between 55 and 64 was $212,000 roughly as of the end of 2019. Now, the average net worth, which is different than the median, which tends to skew higher because of high earning outliers, is actually $1.2 million. So we're going to stick with the median. It's more realistic in this sense for what we're talking about. Net worth is the value of assets you have and any properties you may own, minus any outstanding debt and other liabilities. Given that the median U.S. salary is $68,700, most people don't arrive at their net worth overnight. In fact, very few people start out with millions or even thousands already in the bank, and it takes time to save and invest enough that your net worth is valued at more than a simple emergency fund. In fact, there's still a good chunk of American households that don't even have enough for a $400 emergency. But net worth tends to increase with age since, well, assets appreciate in value over time, and people usually benefit from higher earnings as they move on in their careers. By the time you reach the decade before retirement, you may have plans to finish paying off debt, like a mortgage, and perhaps even ramp up your saving efforts so you can comfortably live off your savings when you do retire. Well, here's a brief breakdown of both the average and median net worth across American households by age, according to the Fed. If you're less than 35, the median is $13,900. The average is $76,300. If you're 55 to 64, median net worth is $212,000. The average, as we mentioned, $1,176,000. And if you're 65 to 74, typically that first decade of retirement, you peak with a median net worth of about $266,000 and an average of $1.217 million. Again, net worth tends to peak in retirement, so you might think of your decade in your late 50s as your final stretch to earn, but also to plan, save, and invest more of your money, particularly investing it wisely. Don't forget about gold and having an adequate amount in whether it's your precious metals IRA or your overall portfolio. As you plan for retirement, plan to prepare for it, looking at your net worth can be a helpful tool in planning for the future. Retirees typically live on fixed income, usually made up of some combination of Social Security income and their retirement investments, though many also draw from other accounts, again, such as precious metals, IRAs. However liberating it may feel to imagine putting your working days behind you, ladies and gentlemen, it's not uncommon for those in their late 50s and 60s to feel a little anxiety at the thought of no longer earning a paycheck. So look at your net worth, because it can help ease this anxiety, looking at it regularly, not occasionally, since it gives you a clear idea of what your resources are, what you have in you and your spouse's name that you can live on or sell, in fact, if you choose to at some point. All right, there's a new Pew Research Center analysis that finds the global middle class encompassed 54 million fewer people last year than the number projected prior to the onset of the pandemic. Meanwhile, the number of poor is estimated to have been 131 million higher because of the recession. The drop-off in the global middle class was centered in South Asia, namely India, and in the East Asia region and the Pacific, and it stalled the expansion seen in the years leading up to last year's pandemic. South Asia, specifically India, along with sub-Saharan Africa, accounted for most of the increase in poverty, reversing years of progress on that front. Now, in a global sense, people who are middle income live on $10 to $20 a day, which translates to an annual income of anywhere between $20,000 and $29,000 for a family of four. Of course, that's modest by the standards of advanced economies like the U.S. In fact, it straddles the official poverty line in the U.S., which is about $23,000 for a family of four in 2020. By global standards, the poor live on $2 or less a day, or no more than $2,900 annually for a family of four. Imagine that, ladies and gentlemen. The number of people in the global high income tier, that's more than $50 a day, is estimated to have decreased by 62 million last year, erasing about half the gain since 2011, with most of the change coming from advanced economies. Meanwhile, the upper middle income population, which is 20 to $50 per day, fell by 36 million, while the low income population, making $2 to $10 daily, is estimated to have increased by 21 million. The erosion in the middle class might have been deeper, according to Pew, if not for the fact that China, which is home to more than one third of the global middle class, evaded an economic contraction, even though growth there was a lot slower than anticipated. The global poverty rate, which had been in steady decline this century, is likely to have increased over 10%, nearly reverting to the 2017 rate, instead of sinking to a new low of 8.7%, as previously expected. Mean world out there, ladies and gentlemen. Let's talk about the Suez for a minute. It's not quite an epilogue to that story yet. A backlog of container ships carrying consumer goods has grown in some strategic ports after a near week-long blockage in the Suez Canal, adding to ongoing disruptions to global trade. Dozens of container ships were stuck in the 430-yard-long Ever Given that ran aground in the canal on March 23rd, with the rescue teams taking almost a week to free the vessel and move it on its way. The suspension of sailings through the waterway left shipping companies, including container lines, with millions of dollars in extra costs, which were not covered by insurance. Reiner Heiken, who's CEO of Hellman Worldwide Logistics, said, "The blockage of the Suez will increase the negative impact on global supply chains in the coming weeks, as the availability of empty equipment, particularly in Asia and Europe, will be affected. Container shipping companies carrying products ranging from mobile phones to designer goods have been contending for months with disruptions. Those troubles have been caused by the pandemic and a surge in demand for retail goods that led to wider logistical bottlenecks, including in the top consumer market, the U.S. of A." Let's just finish that by saying Maersk, who's the world's number one container line, said that its vessels held up in the Suez would be delayed for a number of days before they reached U.S. East Coast ports. Now, while ports on the U.S. East Coast are exposed to any disruptions at the Suez Canal, the surge in demand for retail goods has overwhelmed the West Coast terminals in recent months. The ports of Los Angeles, and Long Beach, which I believe is the largest in the world, both said they were making progress whittling down the backlog, which could be cleared by the end of spring or early summer. That can have some significant impacts, particularly to trade. Now, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has scheduled a hearing for next Wednesday, when it will consider major bipartisan legislation to boost the U.S.'s ability to push back against China's expanding global influence. The draft measure, called the Strategic Competition Act of 2021, mandates diplomatic and strategic initiatives to counteract Beijing. It reflects hardline sentiment on dealings with China from both Democrats and Republicans in Congress, and the bill is intended to address economic competition with the Chinese, but also humanitarian and democratic values. They include imposing sanctions over China's treatment of the minority Muslim Uyghurs and supporting democracy in Hong Kong. It stresses the need to prioritize the military investments necessary to achieve U.S. political objectives in the Indo-Pacific. The bill would expand the scope of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which looks at financial transactions for potential national security risks. The draft legislation also calls for an enhanced partnership with Taiwan, calling the Democratic Self-Governed Island a vital part of the U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy. And it calls on every federal department and agency to designate a senior official to coordinate policies with respect to strategic competition with China. Another clause would limit assistance to countries hosting Chinese military installations, saying Beijing uses its so-called Belt and Road Initiative to advance its security interests and facilitate greater military access. So the swords appear to be drawing one step closer to, well, I'm not going to say military conflict, but certainly to diplomatic stress that we hope does not lead to conflict. Be interesting. I'm sure we'll see a reaction from China as soon as tomorrow, and we'll let you know as this legislation progresses what, if anything, further happens. Now, one other thing, foreign policy-wise, before the show ends today, excuse me, German Chancellor Angela Merkel told Russian President Vladimir Putin today to pull back the Kremlin's military buildup near the border with Ukraine, while Putin in turn accused Ukraine of provocative actions in the conflicted region. Ukraine has raised the alarm over an increase in Russian forces near its eastern border, as violence has risen along the line of contact, separating its troops from Russia-backed separatists in the Donbass region. Russia said its forces posed no threat and were defensive in nature only, but they would stay there as long as Moscow saw fit. A senior Kremlin official said that Moscow could, under certain circumstances, be forced to defend its citizens in Donbass, and that major hostilities could mark the beginning of the end of Ukraine as a country. The Kremlin said its readout of the Merkel phone call that Vladimir Putin noted provocative actions by Kiev, which is deliberately inflaming the situation along the line of contact. In turn, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky flew to eastern Donbass in a show of support today, 2 days after he called on NATO to lay out a path for Ukraine to join the military bloc, whose expansion Moscow fiercely opposes. Now, the ruble hit a five-month low yesterday, a day after Russia said it had begun a planned inspection of its army's combat readiness involving thousands of drills. And today, Dmitry Kozak, a senior Kremlin official, said Ukraine's government were like children playing with matches. Kozak added, "I support the assessment that to start a military action, this would be the beginning of the end of Ukraine." Kozak was asked at a news conference if Russia would protect its citizens in eastern Ukraine, referring to Srebrenica, where about 8,000 Muslim men and boys were killed by Bosnian Serb forces during Bosnia's 1992 war. He replied, "It all depends on the scale of fire. If there is, as our president says, Srebrenica, apparently we'll have to step in to defend them." Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Melody will be back with Butch tomorrow. I'll be back next Tuesday. Also, don't forget to be on the lookout in your email inboxes tomorrow for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival. Have a good evening. Be safe out there. Bye-bye.